Hello, this is Kathleen, and today, Tuesday, August 25th, I'll be reading to you from the Daily News of Newburyport. Firehouse Holding Annual Gala Next Month by Caitlin D., Newburyport. Those looking for a whimsical way to spend an early fall evening need look no further than the Firehouse Center for the Arts Annual Gala next month. This year's party, scheduled for September 11th at the Blue Ocean Event Center in Salisbury, is called Pure Imagination, a night of golden possibilities, and is a chocolate-themed bash. The event is the nonprofit's biggest fundraiser of the year, with hundreds of people, all of whom are encouraged to dress in festive garb and colors like red, orange, and purple, likely to attend. The gala itself will have something for everyone, from a live auction where a number of experiences like a trip to Mexico and a stay at a hotel in Nantucket are on the table, to games like mini golf. There will also be a performance by five-piece band Wildfire, who Valerie Araj, a Firehouse Center for the Arts board member, said was a crowd favorite at a past gala. They've been a performer at one of our prior galas, and they've always an audience favorite. People love their music, and they really get the crowd up and dancing. So we're excited to have them, she said. All proceeds from this year's gala will go towards supporting children's programming at the center, which will allow the Firehouse to continue to foster kids' love of performing, something Araj says is critical. I think it's really important that the kids get the opportunity to build up their confidence at a young age, so they're able to more easily do things like public speaking or stand up for themselves or interact in a very positive way with other people and just build overall confidence, she said. Children from the programs will also be performing at the event, according to Bonnie Butkus, Firehouse Executive Director, who said attendees will have the chance to interact with the kids benefiting from the programs firsthand. I'm really excited for the folks coming to the gala to get a better understanding of our education programs and meet some of the students and meet our director of education, she said. Alongside the fact that the event is supporting an important cause, Araj said it also is a fan favorite amongst attendees, with the Firehouse receiving a slew of positive feedback each year after their galas. Every year after this event, we get so many wonderful comments about how fun it was, how uplifting it was to be with other members of the community, just celebrating the Firehouse and what it's all about, she said. On the flip side, the gala also shows staff and board members at the Firehouse how much the community supports their endeavors, which Araj said is touching. It's really, really inspirational to know that there is so much support in the community, which is great, she said. Individual tickets for the event are being sold for $175 each. Those interested in learning more about the gala or purchasing tickets can visit the event's website at https://afsevenfivesixb63-19b2-4C50-9AC6-FA9AE311D17-3/AA6CD270-8715-1E9-A741-3FCF CB35CBB0. Early Voting Underway in Salisbury, Amesbury by Caitlin D. Salisbury. Local residents are heading out to the polls this week, albeit not in droves, to engage in early voting ahead of the September 1st state primary election. The primary election has multiple contested races, with incumbent Senator Edward Markey and his challenger, Congressman Seth Moulton, both vying for the Democratic nomination in the race for U.S. Senator. On a more local level, Newburyport-based State Representative Dawn Shand and her challenger, Salisbury lawyer Stephen Roth, are trying to secure the Democratic nomination in the race to represent 1st Essex at the State House and more. In Salisbury, early voting began on Saturday at Town Hall, with residents able to cast their vote in the town clerk's office. In-person early voting will continue through Friday, with the polls opening each day at 8:30 a.m. and closing at various times. So far, it has been slow going in Salisbury, with Town Clerk Melinda Morrison saying only 13 people cast their vote at Town Hall on Saturday. She based the slow trickle of visitors to the option of mail-in voting. Since vote by mail was created, it has been an extremely low turnout of in-person early voting, she said. Amesbury residents are also casting their votes at City Hall this week, with voting to run through Thursday. The polls open each day at 10 a.m. and close at varying hours. Amesbury Mayor Cassandra Gove did not respond to a request for comment in time for this report. While early voting will continue through the end of the week, Morrison said she expects that the level of turnout will remain the same and estimated that less than 20 people will vote in person during each day of early voting. However, the number of mail-in ballots requested for this election is much higher, with approximately 700 ballots being sent out to residents and a return rate yet to be determined, Morrison said. Overall, Morrison said low turnout for a primary election like this one is not uncommon, as general elections typically garner more voters. The primaries tend to be a much lower turnout than obviously the general election, she said. But Morrison said she still encourages residents to exercise their right to vote in the primary election, whether that be in person or by mail. Come out. There are races on both sides. You have the opportunity to take your time and vote in person, early at the office, she said. Similarly, Salisbury Town Manager Neil Harrington urged residents to cast their vote in the upcoming election and engage in the democratic process. The strength of our electoral system depends on the participation of citizens in voting. There are important races to be decided in the upcoming primary election on September 1st, and I urge all Salisbury residents to exercise their constitutional right to make a difference by voting, he said. Groups urge court to enforce injunction on mail voting by Christian M. Wade, State House reporter, Boston. A coalition of voting access groups are asking a federal judge to enforce an injunction blocking President Donald Trump's order restricting mail-in voting ahead of the midterms. In a new legal filing in U.S. District Court in Boston on Saturday, the American Civil Liberties Union, League of Women Voters, and other groups are called on the court to enforce an August ruling prohibiting the U.S. Postal Service from implementing Trump's executive order restricting mail voting while the legal challenge plays out. In August, U.S. District Court Judge Indira Palwani issued a preliminary injunction blocking Trump's directive in response to a lawsuit filed by the ACLU and voting rights groups. The executive order is presently causing confusion and threatening both an increasing chaos and an erosion of trust in our democracy, Talwani, an Obama appointee, wrote in the ruling. Enfranchisement heavily outweighs the executive's attempt to unconstitutionally insert itself into the domain of election regulation. Despite the ruling, the Trump administration on Friday directed the U.S. Postal Service to prepare to add new verification requirements to all mail-in ballots delivered through the federal system. Under the proposed rules, which would only go into effect if the U.S. Supreme Court lifts the injunction, states would be required to report basic voter information, such as names and home addresses, on a unique barcode on every mail-in ballot. The ballots would be fed into a portal before they are accepted into the mail stream, USPS said. The agency said the new requirements will facilitate enforcement of federal law, reduce the risk of fraud, and help protect the integrity of federal elections. No other voter information, such as a birth date, Social Security number, or other voter registration details, will be uploaded to the portal, the USPS said. The Postal Service will not play any role in determining voter eligibility, maintaining voter rolls, or counting ballots. But the plaintiffs in the lawsuit said the final rule threatens further chaos for voters, civic organizations, and election officials by seeking to impose last-minute changes to mail voting rules. Enforcement of the court's preliminary injunction is necessary to hold this administration accountable for its unlawful action and makes clear that voters can confidently cast their mail ballot free from federal interference this November, they said. Under the Constitution, states administer federal elections, but Trump has called for expanding federal control since losing in the 2020 race for president. Trump has for years spread unproven claims about widespread voter fraud involving non-citizens and mail-in ballots. Democrats and voting access groups sued to block the president's order, claiming the president seeks to interpose a federal screening regime between voters and the ballot box by empowering a federal mail carrier to withhold those voters' ballots. At least five lawsuits have been filed, seeking to block the order from going into effect. A federal judge in June blocked a Trump order signed last year, requiring proof of citizenship to cast ballots following a legal challenge from Massachusetts and other blue states. In Congress, House Republicans are pushing a bill called the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act, or SAVE Act, that would require proof of citizenship to register to vote. Massachusetts is among the states that count mail-in or absentee ballots as long as they are postmarked by Election Day. The state implemented no-excuse mail-in voting during the height of COVID-19 pandemic, and Beacon Hill leaders approved a bill in 2022, making the voting options permanent for federal, state, and local elections. Prior to the changes, Massachusetts only allowed mail-in voting for absentee ballots. Voters needed an excuse, such as a disability, not to cast ballots in person. Election officials say the changes have expanded options for the Massachusetts voters and that claims of widespread fraud in the system are unfounded. More than 282,000 Massachusetts voters have already cast mail ballots ahead of the September 1st state primary. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of other voters have turned in applications for ballots to vote by mail in the November 3rd general election, according to the Secretary of State's office. A culture war over the trans athletes invades the WNBA and ratings soar. Their View by Lorraine Ali. File under stupid publicity stunt that I shouldn't even be writing about, but here I am writing about it. Last week, former NBA players Enes Kanter-Freedom and Royce White demanded they be officially declared eligible for the 2027 WNBA draft. White, who recently lost the Republican primary for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by retiring Minnesota Senator Tina Smith, has claimed to be transgender and argued that he should be allowed to play in the women's league. "I identify as sometimes identifying as a woman for purposes of professional basketball," he told Fox News. White also posted pictures of himself wearing a wig, stating that he was embracing his feminine era. Designed to mock the trans community and troll the organization and its inclusion and self-identification policies, the former NBA players suggested they would take legal action if blocked from the WNBA draft. They're among the legions of attention seekers, influencers, news media, and activists taking sides in a culture war over something that's not even close to happening. The WNBA's inclusion of transgender athletes. To be clear, no transgender players are slated to become part of the league's roster. A right-wing uproar over an imagined threat. Where have we seen this before? The debate was sparked not by an impending reality, but instead by comments from a player who is no stranger to controversy. In an ESPN profile published last month, Indiana Fever guard Sophie Cunningham stated that biological men should not compete in women's sports, calling the position common sense to protect young girls and Title IX. Agitation is nothing new for Cunningham. She's been called MAGA Barbie since her college days, partly because of the conservative influencers she follows and engages with on social media. Cunningham has become a conduit for MAGA grievances, and her knack for garnering attention has been a boon for those championing right-wing causes. The remarks drew activist groups to rally outside WNBA games, heightening tensions inside arenas, and became grist for MAGA influencers such as competitive swimmer turned political activist Riley Gaines. Capitalizing on the fear of transgender athletes participating in women's sports and stoking outrage among conservatives about what the left may do should they return to power has been a winning move for the Trump administration. In February 2025, President Donald Trump signed an executive order called Keeping Men Out of Women's Sports. That was designed to withhold federal funding from organizations that do not abide by the administration's view that a person's sex is the gender they were assigned at birth. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said last month that men should not be playing in women's sports. "It is completely ludicrous that anyone could support that," she said. "It's even more ludicrous that you do have Cunningham, a female athlete herself, very accomplished in her own right, coming forth and speaking that truth that men should not play in women's sports. We want to protect women and girls and the backlash she is receiving from Democrats and left-wing figures across the country is astonishing." The WNBA last week criticized those trying to create a false narrative about transgender women playing in the league. "There are no immediate eligibility matters affecting the WNBA, and we strongly denounce the bad faith efforts to use these topics to demean or marginalize others," a league spokesperson said last week in a statement. There is no league cause that states self-identification as a woman is sufficient to establish eligibility. Article 8, Section 1A of the WNBA's 2026 collective bargaining agreement says, only players who are women are eligible to play in the WNBA. The policy does not explicitly define the term woman. Cunningham says she doesn't have anything against the transgender community. I got a lot of negative feedback about me hating trans, and I'm like, I never once said that. I think that I am here to extend love, she said in an ESPN article. But I also think with that love is truth, being honest, and I want to protect young girls in a locker room or young girls in a sport who shouldn't have to go against biological men. The vitriol around her comments has become so pronounced that the player's name has reportedly been banned on the WNBA subreddit, where the league's forum won't allow the words Cunningham, Sophie, SC, S. Cunningham, Soph, or Sophia Cunningham. But the attention on Cunningham's comments, the contrived outrage over a fictional trans athlete draft, and dumb stunts by former NBA players have helped drive more folks toward watching the league's games. ESPN reported its second most watched regular season WNBA game in 30 years, when New York Liberty-Indiana Fever matchup averaged 2 million viewers last week. A culture war aimed at denigrating the league may be doing just the opposite, creating fans no matter how they identify. Starter boat hauls in 1,260-pound marlin by Patrick Whittle from the Associated Press. Damon Sacco had never seen anything like the fish he and fellow anglers fought for hours in the waters off Massachusetts. As it rose from the depths, it looked like a glimmering blue spaceship. Sacco, a longtime Massachusetts charter fishing boat captain, saw the giant fin break the surface, and at first thought he was dealing with an enormous shark. Then I got a better look at it and thought, dang, that thing's pointed, he said, but that's too big for a marlin. He was wrong. Sacco and his client, Walter Chapman, landed what they and others believe is the largest Atlantic blue marlin ever caught off the U.S. East Coast on Wednesday. The massive billfish, more than 11 feet in length, weighed 1,260 pounds when they got it back to land in Falmouth, Massachusetts. That was just 142 pounds shy of the world record for an Atlantic blue marlin, caught off Brazil in 1992, according to records kept by the International Game Fish Association. To catch such a huge fish off New England might be even more remarkable, said Walt Golette, director of the University of Maine Pelagic Fisheries Lab and an associate professor at the university's Marine Sciences School. The water is too cold for them in the Northeast most of the year, making the window to catch a big one very narrow. The fish's head was on its way to the U Marine Lab to determine its age, said Golette, who speculated that it could be in the range of 25 to 30 years. I don't suspect there will be a whole lot of blue marlin caught in the Atlantic, in general, that are going to top 1,200 pounds for the next several years, he said. On the day of the catch, Sacco's charter boat, Castafari, was fishing Atlantis Canyon, an underwater canyon on the edge of the continental shelf, about 100 miles off Cape Cod. The highly migratory blue marlin is a seasonal visitor to the area, Golette said. The battle with the marlin took about 3 hours and was fought on rod and reel by Chapman. Sacco said his role for most of the adventure was to drive the bus around and yell at people. He added that the fish left a couple of holes in the boat's transom with its bill that he considers war marks. Chapman, a retiree and lifelong fisherman from Plymouth, said the meat of the fish was divided among about a dozen people, and he's currently looking up recipes for what he'll do with it. He said the marlin is unquestionably the biggest fish he's ever fought on a line, and some of it's probably destined for fish chowder. I wasn't going to eat a 1,200-pound fish all by myself, Chapman said. When the boat returned to the docks, a crowd was waiting, and weighing the fish became a brief spectacle. Onlooker Katie Curran of Falmouth said it was spectacular. People fish their entire lives and never come close to a catch like this, Curran said. Hats off to Captain Damon Sacco and the crew on the catch of a lifetime. Newburyport Art presents new photo exhibit. Newburyport. Newburyport Art recently announced its newest photography exhibit, Fleeting Moments, Spontaneous Photography, by featured artist Geordie Vining. Vining has worked as Newburyport's senior project manager for 25 years. Among the projects Vining has overseen was the creation of the Clipper City Rail Trail from concept to completion. He also managed design and construction of the Senior Community Center, the John F. Cutter Jr. Fire Station, and the Harbor Master Visiting Boater Facility, as well as co-founded the award-winning Newburyport Black History Initiative. Outside of his work for the Newburyport Planning Office, Vining is a photographer who focuses on capturing a range of unplanned photographs of unique fleeting moments. His photographs are nearly all spontaneous and unplanned, ranging from close-ups to wide shots, from vibrant colors to classic black and white. The images are of people, townscapes and cityscapes, landscapes, the natural world, and abstract or ambiguous scenes. Many of his pictures are of his home in New England, but also from other parts of the United States, as well as countries like Norway, Portugal, Canada, France, England, Italy, Croatia, Japan, and a growing list of others. Join Newburyport Art for a free opening reception on Wednesday, September 2nd, from 5 to 7 p.m. Fleeting Moments Spontaneous Photography is partially supported by the Newburyport Cultural Council, West Newbury Cultural Council, and Mass Cultural Council. The handicapped accessible galleries are free and open to the public Wednesday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. All works are for sale. More information as well as an online gallery is available at newburyportart.org. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you all have a safe and well day.